The Rest Court of Appeals is now in session. May all who come here be heard. May truth and justice be served by what we do here.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Nebraska Court of Appeals, the Kearney panel, our other colleagues. Their panel is sitting in Papillion this week. My name is Frankie Moore. I'm from North Platte, and I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Francie Reedman from Gretna on my left and Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln on my right. Before we begin, I want to welcome the UNK Rural Law Opportunity Program students that are here today. We're very pleased that you are with us. We hope you can stay for the three cases, and we'll be happy to visit with you and answer questions when we finish. With that, we will get started. We have three cases on the call this afternoon, and the first one is State versus Quinn. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Judge. All judges, good afternoon, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Charles Brewster. I'm with Anderson, Klein, Brewster, and Brandt here in Kearney. And I am here on behalf of the appellant, William Quinn. Mr. Quinn was convicted in the Furnas County District Court after a jury trial on numerous felony counts, very serious felony counts. And on December 22, 2021, he was sentenced to the Nebraska Department of Corrections to 176.5 to 304 years. Appellant's trial counsel withdrew after the trial, but they did perfect the appeal. Judge Doyle appointed me to represent Mr. Quinn at that time, and that's what I'm doing. This case was actually tried by Judge Erbaum, and Judge Erbaum retired, and Judge Doyle had to pick up the matter for sentencing purposes. So, Your Honor, the first thing I want to talk about today is the client's, Mr. Quinn's, claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Under Strickland versus Washington, the elements that we have to show is that there was deficient performance of counsel and that this deficient performance of Mr. Quinn's trial counsel prejudiced him. Now, I acknowledge that no defense of a criminal case is perfect. We all make mistakes when we defend criminal cases. Hopefully they're not very many, one, two, maybe three. But in this case, I would suggest to the court that trial counsel's mistakes were numerous and quite prejudicial. This was a very, very long trial with a massive amounts of evidence. I think there were, I don't remember for sure, 140 exhibits and maybe 30 witnesses that testified. I don't have the exact number. But the state's case in this matter consisted of a huge amount of text and cyber communications, which is pretty typical we see these days. And during the course of the trial, Mr. Quinn's counsel, they didn't raise any objections to any of this. There were chain of custody issues that you'll see in the record. There were foundational issues, which, in my opinion, as appellate counsel, should have been raised. And it even got to the point that at the end of the state's case, one of Mr. Quinn's attorneys stipulated to the foundation requirements for hundreds of text messages and the contents of cell phones. He didn't raise those objections. And the comment in the record that you can read was he said, well, let's save some time and we'll stipulate to this.
do you allege in your brief that there were foundational problems with any of those communications, or are you simply arguing it's per se negligence?
I think it's per se negligence, and I'll tell you this. Obviously, I've been around for a while, and there's nothing more challenging for me than to figure out just exactly what foundation should be laid for the purposes of getting text messages into evidence, or Snapchat's the worst that I've found. It's horrible. And fortunately, there's some guidance from, I think, your court on how to do that I've read. But with all of this evidence, and it was scattered among several different law enforcement officers that were managing it, trial counsel should have said, you know what, we need to have foundation for all of this, because I think that this evidence was what really brought the defendant's case to its knees. I mean, it was just overwhelming. So the fact that they didn't do that, in my mind, Your Honor, is what I would suggest is cumulative, ineffective assistance of counsel, and I believe it warrants reversal.
Mr. Brewster, I'd like to...
Yes, Judge.
I'd like to ask you about your arguments related to sufficiency of the evidence. You seem to put a lot of weight on the fact that this victim didn't produce a birth certificate, and the only evidence of her age, and age being critical to the offenses of the human trafficking of a minor and the first-degree sexual assault of a child, her age being a critical factor. Are you arguing that that's not sufficient, that the victim and her mother testified as to her date of birth?
Under these circumstances, Your Honor, yes, I am suggesting that. This young lady, this poor girl, was, I think if you look at her testimony during the course of the trial, a liar. And during the course of all the time that she was involved with this, you know, it was one lie after another. She told numerous people that she was 18, some people that, you know, she was 15 at one point, and it just went back and forth from that.
Is there any authority that would suggest that a birth certificate is required to establish age?
No. And I'm asking this court to change that. In fact, there's a case, I believe it's a Supreme Court case, that is in a totally different fact pattern than this. Evidence in that case was not through a birth certificate. It was through testimony, and that was enough. I'm suggesting to the court that in this day and age, when those kind of records are available, we should, you know, require the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and I believe that the testimony in this case from the victim and her mother, who was quite prejudiced towards Mr. Quinn, that testimony shouldn't be enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense, they made a motion to dismiss at the conclusion of the state's evidence. Court overruled that, and they went on to offer their own evidence. But the court can still look at that alleged error as to the sufficiency of the evidence, which you just pointed out, and rule on that. So. There is that. I don't remember about the text messages between the victim and her sister, Judge. I'm sorry.
Not between the two of them. I think the message was between the sister and the defendant, perhaps.
Oh, I really don't recall that.
The two of them asking about how old she was.
I remember the text message between Mr. Quinn and the victim, and there was some discussion about, you know, her birthday. And,
right, and then there's that additional testimony about how to celebrate her birthday.
Yeah. And
does the defendant's mistaken belief about about the victim's age matter with regard to the sexual assault?
It does not. That's boilerplate. You know, it doesn't matter what he thought one way or the other. But the truth of the matter, I think the state failed in proving that beyond a reasonable doubt.
You mentioned that it goes to her credibility, but do we reweigh credibility at this stage?
Well, no, you don't. But back to the cell phones and the lack of foundation laid for the cell phones, there again, I mean, a critical piece of evidence there that counsel should have objected to. There's all kinds of things that can go wrong with that kind of evidence. And just because trial counsel wanted to save time, that's not a good enough reason to roll over and play dead and go to sleep on the job. So, I do want to talk for a few moments, if I could, Your Honor, about excessive sentence. I got to tell you, I've been at this business for a long time, and other than life sentences for murders and things of that nature, I've never seen a sentence quite like this. This is essentially three times of a life sentence. When you look at this, Mr. Quinn would be eligible for parole in 111 years, I believe, is what we calculated. The sentence, I believe, Your Honor, is technically correct under the sentencing parameters that all judges are supposed to follow. But here, I think it's obvious that Judge Doyle wanted to impose life sentences on Mr. Quinn, and you know, none of the convictions require that, but he did it anyway. So looks like I'm out of time. Any other questions, Your Honor?
We have no more questions.
All right.
Mr. Brewster,
thank you so much for coming to Kearney. I know it's, well, it's just great to have you here, so I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Just preliminarily, I'll address the foundational with the text messages. Frankly, I don't agree with any of that. I think there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. You have to evaluate that evidence, whether you have to determine whether you have any valid basis for challenging it. This kind of evidence has routinely been admitted. You've got cell phone records, that's from his phone number. It's undisputed that it's from his phone number. You've got statements of a party opponent because they're going back between the two phones. I mean, there's really no basis in, you know, clogging up the court's time, laying needless foundation for something that's coming in anyway. So I don't necessarily agree with that. And in any event, you can't resolve that on direct appeal anyway. You necessarily have to talk to counsel. So I don't intend to address that any further. But Quinn has assigned seven errors on appeal. I intend to address only four, namely the sufficiency of the evidence, the two evidentiary rulings, and the motion for mistrial. The remaining errors I will submit on the brief unless the court has questions. Quinn first claims the evidence was insufficient to establish CG's age, primarily because CG and her mother were not credible and because the state failed to offer her birth certificate into evidence. However, neither argument has merit. It's well settled that witness credibility is for the jury determined and is not to be reassessed on appeal. Moreover, witnesses routinely testify as to birth dates without any corroborating documentation. And as argued in the state's brief, there was other evidence of CG's age, including her sister's testimony, text messages dated September 1st, in which Quinn said, "I wish you were 18 or 20. And she says, "Yeah, me too. The 16 is going to be a little bit better, though," meaning 16 is better than 15. And then, of course, on her birthday, he searched the internet for sweet 16 sex. And I also know that there were a number of the men who testified in this trial who were also charged or convicted of crimes that were age-related offenses. So if there was no credible evidence of her age, of course, that wouldn't have happened either. So clearly, the evidence was sufficient to establish CG's age. Quinn next claims the district court erred by admitting the state's 404 evidence and by excluding Weaver's deposition. Well, I do not agree. I don't believe an extended analysis of either claim is necessary because even if the district court erred, the error was undoubtedly harmless. The disputed evidence was relevant only to the two sex trafficking accounts and, or excuse, counts. And as argued in the state's brief, neither had or would have had any effect on the outcome. The 404 evidence was relatively minor in comparison to the overwhelming direct evidence of Quinn's guilt.
How is the probative value more, how did it outweigh the prejudicial impact?
I think based on the similarity of the transactions, I mean, the state offered it for knowledge, intent, and absence of mistake, or accident. And if you look at the similarity, I mean, he was sexually involved with both females. He encouraged them to have sex with somebody else. He set up those transactions. He set the rate. It was $50. And then, of course, after it was over, he always wanted to know how it went.
But as you indicated, your argument is there's plenty of evidence, sufficiency of the evidence,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Why bring in this potentially highly prejudicial evidence regarding a relationship between the victim's sister and another man entirely?
Well, I think it was just because of the monetary portion of it. The fact that he's setting up these encounters and he's having, you know, sex being exchanged for money. That's obviously what the sex trafficking went to in this case. And so I think they brought it in for that purpose. Do I think they needed it? No. I think they had ample evidence. This went on for several months. You've got multiple men who are coming in and saying, yes, this is how this was presented to me. I paid. You know, she had sex with me. She sent me these text messages and that sort of thing. I mean, I think there was ample evidence. And frankly, if you look at the timing of how that evidence, of when that evidence came in, it was fairly early on, really before all of the compelling direct evidence came in, before all of the men got up and testified, before all of the electronic evidence came in, showing the internet searches and those sorts of things. And so, it's kind of in the rearview mirror, in my opinion. But once
your position is that even if it was error for the court to allow it in, it was harmless error?
Absolutely, yes.
Mr. Brewster didn't address it today, although he did thoroughly in his brief. Let's talk about Senator Sasse's letter.
Yes.
How that impacted the case.
I don't think it had any impact at all. I mean, he wrote the letter, and obviously it's not in the record. You can find it online. I did. And basically what happened is some reporter attended the first day of trial and wrote an article for the Lincoln Journal Star. He read it and then fired off a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice saying, hey, we need some help over here, you know, do something about this. He didn't know any more about the case than that reporter. And so I think if that letter had been admitted into evidence, it certainly would have helped the state. But I think importantly here, the district court kind of like, I'm sure you're all familiar with the trail opinion that came out last Friday, you know, where you had the outburst in court and how the court handled it there, individually questioning the jurors, making sure they could set aside their prejudice. Well, the district court here did the same thing. Basically, you know, and the defense counsel asked for it, too. I said, well, can you individually pull these jurors? That's exactly what happened. Judge Urban pulled them all aside, questioned them, do you know anything about this? 12 of the 14 knew absolutely nothing about it. One of them said, well, I saw something on Facebook, but I scrolled right by it, and in any event, I don't listen to Ben Sasse. And then the last guy said, well, if something came on my TV, I muted it, and I immediately left the room. So nobody knew the content of it. So just to say that, well, Ben Sasse said something out there about this case, well, you know, what does that really tell us? And you have to show actual prejudice. And again, that was reinforced in Trail recently. It's not enough to show that there's the mere possibility of prejudice. You have to show actual prejudice. And here there simply isn't any. And I would also note that he's only challenging the denial of his motion for mistrial. I know that he moved again for a motion for new trial a few days after the case was decided, the verdicts came back. That's not being challenged on appeal. So it's just a motion for mistrial. And I'm saying at that point in time, there's no way you can show actual prejudice. And he's trying to get some sort of an exception to that rule. He's probably in the wrong court. Probably should have filed a petition to bypass and provide some authority for this notion of implied prejudice under certain circumstances. I just don't see it here. So let's see. Oh, and just briefly, I'll go back to Mr. Weaver's deposition that was excluded. I would note that the defense's justification for offering a testimony has morphed a bit over time, but for the only two purposes advanced on appeal, it was clearly cumulative. Multiple witnesses, including the victim, testified that she was 18, and she communicated directly with these men through text messages and on Snapchat, so I don't believe there was any reversible error with respect to either of those evidentiary rulings. But that concludes my prepared remarks, so unless the court has any additional questions, I would.
I guess the last argument was about the sentence, if you'd like to address that.
Sure.
Sentences.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think this is excessive, particularly when you look at how long this went on, the nature of the conduct. I mean, this girl was being pimped out all over town, not to mention all of the times that he had sex with her when she was 15, then again when she was 16. I mean, and you look at each count individually, and I think it was State v. Becker from the Supreme Court, where they talk about when you're looking at excessive sentences, you look at the sentences individually, or for Eighth Amendment purposes even, you look at them individually. He ran a lot of these concurrent. I mean, I think, and this isn't in the record either, but I think the state offered to let him plead to three counts. They said no, he chose to go to trial on 14, he was convicted of 13. These are all very serious charges. Three of them carry mandatory minimums of 15 years, and the court ran the first five consecutive, grouped, I think, believe the next seven or so, concurrent, made them concurrent and consecutive to the first five, and then tacked on the child abuse sentence at the end. And so when you look at this, when you look at this conduct overall and the sentences, which, you know, weren't really that stiff for each one, when you look at the penalty range that was available and what was actually given, I don't think there's any basis for finding that these are excessive. I mean, this was, there was a lot of damage done. There were a lot of people that got hurt by this. And, you know, and I'm not absolving any of the other men who were involved in this of their criminal responsibility. I think there's plenty of that. It's plenty of blame to go around in this situation. But the reality is Quinn was the common denominator in all of these encounters. And if it hadn't been for him, they never would have met her, let alone had sex with her. So do I think the sentence is excessive? Not a chance.
We have no further questions.
Okay, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Brewster's out of time.
Yes, I am.
So thank you both, counsel. Your case is submitted and you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.